Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century, and welcome to the very last episode in our seven-part series on The Enchantments of Mammon, How Capitalism Became the Religion of Modernity by Eugene McCarracher, that we have been doing with our network comrades over at the Red Library. Red Library and From 78 are, along with us, the Lost Horizons Network, so don't forget to go check them out. And if you like us and you think that we're worth a couple of bucks a month, go check out our Patreon and get access to our irregularly posted special episodes, our extra content that wouldn't fit in the regular episodes, and our, turns out to be about once a month, patron roundtables. But any of our patrons can go to our Discord, discuss what they'd like to talk about, and then join in a discussion that is recorded and posted on our patron feed. Okay, well, I think that's about it. Enjoy the final episode of our Enchantments of Mammon series.
How did you guys ever become a superpower? How?
We got real fucking lucky, Mir.
A shitload of free land and slave labor were two.
That's how we became a power, the way we became a superpower.
The U.S. became a superpower because all the other powers in the world destroyed each other twice over, and we stepped in toward the end both times.
And we just sat on our hands and exported weapons to everyone.
Smart.
Iron ore to Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany wouldn't have been able to continue on the war without Swedish iron ore.
No, exactly. And we had our own concentration camps for communists, so on and so forth, and Sami people.
I didn't realize that about Sami people.
Oh, that's... they were forcefully sterilized until, like, the 80s.
Jesus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Mammon Part 7. This is the final Mammonization of our podcast supergroup. We have Red Library, Regrettable Century, and Mirror in the house. Everybody say what's up.
What's up?
Hey.
Yo, what up?
God damn it. Hey, you idiots. Say who you are. This is Chris.
This is Kevin.
This is Jason from the Regrettable Century.
This is Adam from Regrettable Century. I'm not on y'all's show. We just got incepted. This is Adam from Red Library. It's just me.
We just completed our takeover.
Yeah, exactly. It's all right. We're all one hive mind. It's just me.
That's right.
The other Red Troika folks are out today, so I am the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit all in one.
Damn.
And this is Mir from Sweden, your comrades in Christ, who is basically infiltrating you all.
So, Adam's a Unitarian heretic.
Hell yeah. I'm putting an O Fortuna behind this intro, by the way, if I do the edit.
To the stake!
All right, so this is, we're doing part 7, One Vast and Ecumenical Holding Company, the Prehistory of Neoliberal Enchantment, 1945 to 1975. So this was the last section of the book, and he looks at the post-war period and the appearance of and rise of neoliberalism, which would be to take hold, post-75. So, in the tradition of how we've done it before, any thoughts on this intro section and the intro portion of to part 7, thoughts on the section as a whole?
This is my favorite section of the whole book, easily.
Yeah. It is both my favorite and my least favorite. Favorite because it's definitely well done. Least favorite because it deals with my least favorite people.
Oh yeah. I also just want to say
modern neoliberals.
Right. I also want to say that for anyone that just watched the newest Adam Curtis documentary that came out, the resonance between that and this chapter is really astonishing. I almost read this whole section in the Adam Curtis like voiceover voice is what I did pretty much.
I think that this was probably my favorite section too, because it's the one that deals with the period in history that we're still living in. That's debatable, but it's at least the prehistory to the moment we're living in. And because I was sort of surprised, and pleasantly so, that McCarracher invokes the authority of Guy Debord. So, not enough people do that. And also like that he also adds his own sort of thoughts about the how amenable sort of countercultural sort of aesthetic rebellion is to you know, the pecuniary and technological rationality. But yeah, I think like the not taking to task, but the sort of the balance sheet on the new left and the sort of strategies and mode of resistance that we've sort of inherited, the ones that we're still grappling with today. I think it's useful. It's like maybe the most politically useful, even if that's not even his own intent. Although I did listen to an interview with the author about the book, and it does appear as though that is sort of his whole point, is this last section. It's like really driving everything toward this series of arguments. And I think he does a good job with it.
I have to agree with everyone above, but I'm also a bit skeptical of the way the author is, how shall I put this, emphasizing the peculiarity of American Protestantism and the American ideology to the neoliberal project. Because the neoliberal project has taken root and did take root as a transnational and transatlantic networks of projects in vastly different cultures. So I think his mode of explanation does not take that into account. He's also not fair to the basically to the most of the neoliberals themselves, like Hayek. Really grappled with a lot of these questions and came down with answers and problematizing of capitalism that he does not raise, because that would not fit his thesis.
So I figure I wanted to give a little bit of an overview of what the section covers. The part seven, he titles One Vast and Ecumenical Holding Company, which he takes from a quote as a quote from the movie The Network, in a speech being given during it, where one of the characters says, "The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale, one vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused." So for McCarahare, this quote, I think, encapsulates this section, which I think y'all have rightly identified is the culmination of his thesis. Specifically, he talks about this being realized in the ideological realm of, and he covers in each of the subsequent chapters, he talks about the symbolic universe of the spectacle of advertising, art, and business. He talks about the origins of neoliberalism in, you know, Ayn Rand and other contemporary thinkers to her. He talks about the appearance of the counterculture in the Cold War period, which was the pre-beatnik even and pre-hippie counterculture, and its appearance in corporate counterculture, and the way that it parallels an insurgent libertarianism, free market fundamentalists. He addresses the appearance of the new left, and then he also raises in this period the appearance of other, what he deems just, quote, other critics, which again, I think, as we've noted before, this section belies his own fealty and admiration for this school of thought. I think he calls these other critics, quote unquote, as hearkening back to the arts and crafts movement and reviving a new romanticism that was, you know, neither a subsidiary of corporate bohemia nor a hospice for bourgeois discontent. So with that, the first chapter that he gets into, he talks about, he titles it Gods in His Heaven, All's Right with the World, the Political Economy of Containment and the Economic Theology of the Cold War. This section was about Cold War liberals, basically saying, and their views on how American capitalism is perfect. It has struck this perfect balance in the world of separating the owner and manager from capital and distributing ownership and benefit of capital throughout the population in a sort of Bernsteinian sense.
What did y'all think of the quote from Elaine Tyler May about domestic containment? Do y'all remember that? It's like right on the first page of the chapter. Well, we did a prior chapter on containment, and I thought it was a good connection point here. This is on, let me see, just for anyone that wants to follow along, this is on 517. McHare Harris says, focusing on the suburban hearth, domestic containment attempted to bridle an array of potentially disruptive demands of women for greater autonomy, of workers for workplace power, and of non-whites for legal and social equality. The corporate commonwealth was a political economy of containment, which I found really interesting. I had never encountered the idea of containment being a domestically applied policy in the U.S. in this particular way. I thought it made a lot of sense, though.
Yes, and it's also quite clear that the strategy of domestic containment was only possible due to the quite absurd economic growth and also the possibility to distribute that growth. Like, the Democrats are trying, or at least attempting the rhetoric of trying, that type of domestic containment today, but with the falling rate of profit that has basically become impossible in the economic landscape we have right now.
Yeah, I think there was a quote from Paul Krugman in the little introduction section, I think is maybe a good thing to touch on. So, R.I.P. Kevin, this is in your notes. You said, the so-called golden age of capitalism turned out to be, in Paul Krugman's words, an interregnum between gilded ages, which I think is something really important to think about, because a lot of liberals, I think, still talk about capitalism or the necessity to preserve capitalism as if the golden age of capitalism can, you know, extend forever, or we can still preserve that in a way without a recognition of, yeah, maybe that was just a very brief blip in the historical development of capitalism, and now we're just right back to a new robber baron age.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you play Civilization, man, you know that the golden age comes to an end at some point.
Yeah, nothing gold can stay, as they said in The right. Outsiders.
Yeah, I really like the statement here, like, I can't remember who wrote it, but the no man who owns his own house could become a communist, you know?
Yeah.
Because when you think about how few people actually own their houses today in real terms, as opposed to just like constantly leasing forever and having like double mortgages or whatever, it actually does seem, you know, it follows that there's a certain logic to it that's true, that like it has served as an effective strategy for containment for a while, but Mir, like you said, it's not possible. So it's not sustainable. And now there are a whole bunch of people who own their own houses who are like so economically distressed they might become communists because of it.
Or at least join the DSA. Mean,
yeah.
Or at least, I mean, yeah.
Or become like rabid right wingers.
Yeah, I think unfortunately that's more,
I agree,
more likely, for the reason that this double mortgages creates weird, really weird incentives. Also the fact that the idea that we are returning to a gilded age is a bit too optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredibly astute to notice the economic function of distributed individual property ownership, the way that this functions in the economy is to prop up capitalism. I agree with Mir that it's it tends to create an economic incentive structure that resembles the petite bourgeoisie across the population generally, which lends itself to a far right affinity. That said, we're entering in a period where people have grown up in a world where they've expected individual small property ownership, but not that is becoming increasingly less realistic for more and more people, and a lot of the small property owners are getting really fucked out of their small property ownership and thrust back into the same position as the rest of the proletariat, which we'll see where that leads. But
yeah, because in both Sweden, Scandinavia, and in Great Britain, we have seen the same trends with privatization of housing, with great amounts of debt, and the political trajectory of these petite bourgeoisie has either been right-wing populists or this kind of, for the more aspiring classes, this kind of woke lords that claims that Bernie Sanders is male chauvinist and we need pink drones in Syria. Yeah. Hailed by our savior Hillary Clinton.
Well, so to that point, let me point that this chapter made that I thought was extremely salient was the section where he talks about how man cannot live without an economic theology, and that the American way of life was the operative faith of the American people. And it was a bona fide religion, complete with its rituals, its holidays, its liturgy, its saints, and its sancta. This included capitalist economics, individual responsibility, and a facile idealism, all incarcerated in a host of objects, from the flag to indoor plumbing to Coca-Cola bottles, the enchanted tokens of post-war capitalism. And importantly, I think he notes that Galbraith, the thinker that he's discussing here, predicted that despite their acceptance of administrative routines, middle-class Americans would continue to praise free enterprise and private property, quote, long after its substance had deserted them, end quote. Mm. And I think that is an incredibly prescient prediction that Galbraith was making there. I think one of a little bit later, he identifies some a way that this ideology was entrenched in people that I thought was very instructive, which was a recognition of the managerial class, of the business class. A school of business thought that you learn when you get a degree in business. It was to the need to inculcate a managerial attitude in the worker, in the worker, which is not to inculcate a directive capacity, but rather to inculcate an identification with the goals of the manager, i.e., you succeed when you make profit for the company. Your interests are tied to the interests of the company that you work for.
Cuck shit.
Exactly. And this, I think, was a very successful, intentional project by the ownership class.
Yeah. I was just thinking of, the scene from, the Bible. I think it's like in Kings or something with, the contest between Elijah and the prophets of Baal, where they set up an altar and then they call down fire, and the prophets of Baal can't do it because their god is fake, and then Elijah does it and fire comes out of the sky and lights up his altar, and then the people kill the prophets of Baal and tear down the altar. But this reminds me of if like the Elijah would have called down fire, and then the prophets of Baal would have been like, yeah, but like Baal's still dope, That's the American working class, and it's a continued insistence on the promise of the pecuniary reason of neoliberal mammonism.
Yeah, when I was reading this section, something that popped up in my mind when I read about the American way of life as a bona fide faith. I was reminded of this video, and I'll send it to people if they're interested. But there's a bunch of these, like middle era Cold War type sort of propaganda films about like little cartoons about like the only ism is Americanism, and then there's like a guy who's under the sway of various foreign ideas, and there's just, it's like ism. It's like, gotta watch out when someone comes along with an ism. Here's what he's trying to do, and here's what he's trying, and it's like, you know, it's something that we don't have, right? We haven't grown up with those things, but the previous generation did grow up with like a deliberate program of like inculcating a particular set of ideas that identify with. It's even where you get like un-American as a concept, right?
Yeah. I remember like, old Boomer and like Gen X hippies always saying like, "Oh, I'm not into isms."
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. So it's interesting because it was never. I just really never like had it presented. Maybe I have, but I hadn't really ever thought of it quite as much as a deliberate political project, as a deliberate like spiritual project. But McCarraher, he's very right.
I mean, he's completely right in that it takes spiritual forms, but the underlying material problem for us communists to deal with is the fact that the long-term and the short-term interests of working-class people, of employees, are very different. It is in the short-term interest of each and every worker to produce profit for their managers, but the long-term interest is something completely different. But we don't have a way of combining those two. And that's, I am intrigued by his argument, but I'm also skeptical of the overemphasis on ideology and the fact that he does not recognize that, well, it is actually in the short-term interests of workers to self-identify with their managers and with their employers.
I think that is right. I think that is a general note to make about McCarraher's text, mm-hmm. is that it is a study of ideology. If we were to use a Marxist lens on this, it is a study of ideology, and it is it's a sort of a Foucaultian genealogy of ideas rather than like a Marxist analysis of material relations giving rise to or being related to, connected to ideas across time. So I mean, that is something to note in the text broadly.
I mean, like the project of creating the material conditions that make the worker identify with their own interests as opposed to the interests of the ruling classes, the Marxist project of decucking the working class.
That's right. There's also, I mean, there's part of the reason why I think we have to talk so often about ideology and about like sort of superstructural questions is because, Mir, you're right that as an individual worker, your immediate material interests are often more easily, if not actually aligned, but at least able to be more identified with like the profitability of the firm, if only because that's why you get to keep your job, at least in theory, right? As opposed to getting laid off. Although the experience of plenty of American workers suggests that actually if you make your company too profitable, they'll get laid off for that instead. But at least you can see why that's the case, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's the collective interest, right? The class interest, which is often not at all the same as the interest of the individual worker. That's something that's a lot harder to, that doesn't just occur to somebody in some empirical way. You don't like look out the window and see class interest, right? You just have your own immediate experience. That's the whole reason why we are Marxists, right? Because if we weren't, we would be, if we thought that you would just by virtue of living, you would recognize common interests with everybody else who works for a paycheck as opposed to writing a paycheck. We actually do think we have something specific to offer in terms of making the case based on what degree of your interests are obvious to you, but connecting it to all the things which are not. I think it's to our, I do think that there's a way that we overemphasize so-called cultural ideological questions, especially in the wake of a non-labor left from the new left onward. But the reason why we do it is because there is a recognition that we have to, even if we don't do it very well. At least that's what I think.
I mean, no spoilers here, but I think this is directly going to implicate his conclusions at the end of the whole section about it. I mean, yeah. I think that whenever you start with the idea of like an ideological critique, and I think from a very clearly, you know, sort of soft communist or like anarchist politics, I think you always lead to the kinds of conclusions that he's going to come to. So I'm curious for us to have some daggers pulled out for where he ends up settling, because we've been asking this question the whole time. It's like, okay, where is he eventually going to come down on, like, what is his response to this? I'm of two minds about it. I'm very sympathetic, but also I am ruthlessly critical of it.
So just to close this section, he also notes, he also delineates some a few writers and thinkers who he calls insider critics of corporate business of the time period, who noted issued interesting critiques from the inside of this world, identifying things like alienation and resentment that existed within the working class, even within the heralded post-war period. And he says that this period, or these criticisms, were largely concerns about mass society, or presented as concerns about mass society and bureaucracy, depersonalization of relationships in bureaucracy and mass communications, this sort of thing. But he notes that these thinkers were largely left without knowing what to do about it. They just sort of saw this as a feature of this society and were like, well, I'm not sure what to do about this.
So let me tag a quote to end this section. This is from Davenport. This is on 522. McCarrier says, abandoning fortune's upbeat cliches, Davenport warned that middle-class Americans were drifting into a playland of desperation that identified the good life with the products of modern industry. More than any corporate humanist before him, Davenport suspected that the capitalist West was a glittering desert of nihilism. This is Davenport. It is nothing that we must fear. The thought of nothing, the sound of nothing in our hearts, the belief in nothing.
So let me, let's jump into the next 30-minute segment then. The next chapter, Machines of Loving Grace, auguries of the corporate counterculture.
We're coming for those cyberneticians out there. I'm ready for some of our comrades to get big mad over his critiques of cybernetics.
Yeah, this section, the whole time I was just thinking we should have read this chapter as the basis of our episode forever ago about the problem with fully automated luxury communism.
Yeah. This is also the big Adam Curtis energy chapter. It just after every line I just heard him saying, "But that was a lie."
So this was the corporate counterculture, which he says that he identifies this appearing actually well before beatniks, hippies, or radicalized students. There was a corporate counterculture that was generating the new spirit of capitalism, an ideology of autonomy, liberation, teamwork, and vision that enlisted aesthetic and spiritual desires in the service of new forms of labor discipline.
Yeah, that's from Boltanski and Chiappello as well, which we mentioned in I think the last episode.
Yes, and like it's also, if you want to get the feeling of what he's talking about there, think Mad Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about that the whole time reading this section.
Yeah.
So, Kevin, I'm going to tag on a quote after what you just read as well. It says, theorized in the military science of cybernetics, automation embodied the beatific visions of its designers and corporate sponsors, the mechanization of production and communion envisioned by industrialists and scientific managers. So new brands of managerial thinking, so-called Theory Y, as they were dubbed collectively, anticipated a post-Fordist workplace where employees were given greater autonomy in devising the means of their own exploitation.
Oh, yeah. Like, how many people have you spoken to that work in tech that'll say something like, oh, man, my workplace is so great. Like, you can go, instead of taking the elevator, you can ride a slide down from the first to the second floor. And like, just, you know, there's like this weird way of identifying like their actual workplace with something that's like a fun, more enjoyable place. It's like, it's more creative. You know, you can take naps and,
there are no walls, man. Everyone just like works next to each other. We got video games in the break room.
Yeah. There's even a laundry facility on site. So you don't even have to go home sometimes. You can just stay and like really, really crank out that surplus value, you know?
I mean, fucking babies, do your own fucking laundry, grow up, mentalization of the working class.
Listen, man, I blame the goddamn Swedes. It's the IKEAization of work.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Yeah, but...
Answer him, Mir.
Yeah, but to be fair, the founder of IKEA was like a literal Nazi. He actually was like... He died a couple of years ago, and like he was still hanging out with a bunch of SS officers.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Fucking, you know, Ulrike Meinhof was right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no joke.
You gotta get rid of those motherfuckers.
Yeah, like he was a really bad dude.
We call for a rejuvenation of the RAF.
Oh yes, I am so gay.
Minecraft.
In Minecraft, obviously, yes. In Minecraft.
I call for it in the real world.
Well, according to my lawyer, I apparently am allowed to advocate these things. So
yeah, that's true. You could say whatever the fuck you want, but that doesn't mean that Apple's not going to just fucking nuke your podcast and never even tell you why.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. Well, look, well, none of this shit means anything.
In Minecraft.
So
can we talk about automation hysteria?
I was going to say, I really like the excitement surrounding automation as fusing anxiety and utopian hope. Like it just distills the moment so well to me. You know, my own criticism of automation is that you shouldn't fuse those things together.
I mean, I think
and also that it's fake.
Well, I think the session, what it really sort of hinges on, I think, is kind of what he's saying on page 538 about, you know, there was a huge amount of enthusiasm in the corporate world for automation and people like Peter Drucker and talking about that this was like a utopian dream of capitalists and of the managerial ideologues, right? So I think that's a really important thing to recognize is whenever we talk about automation now and I would dare say even things like cybernetics, just to understand, you know, what was the ideological context in which these ideas were emerging out of and then, you know, just at least having a critical moment to reflect on if we are wanting to advocate for those things, like how did those develop? What context are they arising from? And how are they like structural, not structurally determined, but at least structurally influenced in a way of like what it is that these ideas were designed to address in this like major, you know, moment in capitalist development, I think.
Yes, like it's also if we're about to talk about religion, it's basically Gnostic ideas that's focusing around the total denial of the embodied experience of work. And there's lots of great feminist critiques of the sort of like these male fantasies of overarching system where the body doesn't matter and all that kind of stuff. So this is basically a Gnostic daydream where the knowledge of how to micromanage a system, a closed system, will lead us to salvation through gnosis of the machine.
Yeah, I think that he also connects this up to the general belief in progress as well. He says, like early American fascination with technology, the excitement surrounding automation, like you were saying, Jason, fused anxiety and utopian hope. Acolytes of automation heralded the newest and most breathtaking chapter in the story of progress with a capital P, the ascent to an even higher, more ingenious and productive magnitude of technological sublimity. So automation bad.
Basically, yeah.
So in the chapter, he talks about... He talks about thinkers that were looking at automation and from both the perspective of having anxiety about it and having utopian hope throughout this period. Most, he says, assumed that automation would enlarge the domain of leisure, but some observers argued that it would intensify work and extend the realm of necessity.
It isn't like we have no history of that actually being the case with technological production and capitalist modes of production either.
Yeah, exactly. And every time there comes a wave of technological innovation, there's a wave of people talking about how, oh, we just need to let technology abolish manual labor and then we can, and fully automated luxury communism will just automatically happen because of that. And then every time the reality is that we get that the working class gets poorer and worked harder and with less time off, they get squeezed more.
Yes, and actually the founder of cybernetic theory pointed that out, which McKeraher points out as well. Wiener, I think his name was.
Norbert Wiener.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, him and John von Neumann are kind of the two who developed cybernetics.
And at least Wiener ended up as one of the biggest critic of that whole mindset during his lifetime. And turned to where Judaism with Buddhist for thinking. Yeah.
Well, I just to have some daggers out and shots fired at the cybernetician. So this is on page 544. This is about Norbert Wiener. He says, indeed, as machinery decomposed and reabsorbed more ingenuity, the trajectory of capitalist automation accelerated toward a future of universal human stupefaction and subjugation. Because the automatic machine is the quote-unquote precise equivalent of slave labor, anyone who competes with it must accept the economic conditions of slave labor. Wiener's ominous forecast of technological servitude was even more prescient than his eschewal of military research and his diatribe against megabuck science.
Wow. The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, I really like the note that he makes that I've got different page numbers because I'm on an e-reader, but McKeraher notes that, you know, the widespread concern about automation obscured the more fundamental and intractable issues as the fetish of technology diverted attention from its origins and capital's need to achieve complete mastery of the production process. So he sort of makes the point that both anxiety about automation and utopian visions of the future centered around hopes arising from automation misses the point that what's really happening underneath it is the economic drive of capital to increase profits and expand exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of when we think back to our conversations in the past about the whole fully automated luxury communist dream. I think this is pretty much in line with the kind of the criticisms I've had of it, which is that it's a communism born of a capitalist mentality, like that it doesn't break the bonds, but actually helps reify and reinforce the very ethos of the society we want to undo. And this makes that case very well, I think.
It's like it's the communism of capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like that. Like that's what Spengler called Marxism, was the socialism of capitalism. I think his criticisms were off, but if he would have said that about fully automated luxury communism, I think I would agree with him.
Yeah. Yeah, like this is basically where Kautsky and his comrades ended up late in their life with this really perverse view of both socialism and communism as shareholders in collectively owned, managed, scientifically managed corporations.
What do we think about advertising?
Bad.
Yeah. Totally that's bad. The other part of what he addresses in this section is what he calls a conservative revolution in advertising, where there was the appearance of the capital C, capital R, the creative revolution featured a shift to boutique advertising firms that were outposts of the aforementioned theory Y, that lavishly advertised their independence from aesthetic conventions. So, in what Frank has dubbed the conquest of cool, the creative revolution marked the bourgeois bohemian convergence of Madison Avenue with the counterculture, while creativity appeared to supplant scientific research as the chief mode of legitimation. It obscured the persistence of the century-old ambition to merge instrumental reason with aesthetics. The freedom of the artist with the necessities of the vendor, the longing of a sacramental way of way in the world with the mandates of pecuniary metaphysics. So he says that the old way of advertising was sort of more centered around just finding what people's needs or desires were, and then presenting your your products as satisfying those needs or desires in a sort of scientific presentation of, you know, here's why this product is so great. And then there was a revolution in advertising that shifted toward the recognition that in a capitalist society, needs and desires are infinite, potentially infinite. And advertising needs to center around the construction of desire rather than the presentation of existing products as the potential satisfaction of existing desire.
I had to get up and shut the window because the helicopter was flying by and I didn't want that in the recording. So I missed all that. But I agree.
Yeah. Go ahead. Basically the mad manification of
exactly.
Yeah. Like it's toasted. Lucky Strikes. It's toasted. It's edgy. It's not necessary. It is the Freudian death drive of infinite possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot in this podcast all throughout its history of about this recurring sort of feature of our world, which is the capitalist recuperation of desire, even the desire to overcome the effects of capitalism or even the system itself. And McCarraher doesn't use the word recuperation, right? But he does talk about Debord. He's obviously familiar with this particular sort of line of critique. And I think he does a really good job with it. This is earlier when I was saying this is the best section. I think I've never read, there is the book, right? The Conquest of Cool. But I feel like I want to now that I've read this book.
Yeah. Dichter repackaged futility as constructive discontent, the creative destruction of desire that fueled ever greater investment and innovation. In the age of psychoeconomics, when advertising would come into its own as an industry devoted to the production of consciousness, in the restless heart would stay forever restless, finding an evanescent repose in the eternal obsolescence of commodity culture. Dichter's psychoeconomic age entailed the creative destruction of personal identity through consumption, a search that ceases only in death or lack of money, which amounted to the same. Defining the human in terms of consumer activity, Dichter reduced identity to an ensemble of commodities. And holy shit, is that not a description of our society as it exists now today.
Yeah.
Sad reacts only.
To further that point, the conclusion of Dichter's phenomenology was inexorable. A soul thus projected is redeemed through consumption, a consummation afforded only through the ritual of purchase and the sanctifying grace of money.
How much do y'all think that even for a lot of folks on the left, the idea that, I don't know, aesthetic preferences or certain ways that you signal to others, like what your political ideology is actually sort of a consequence of this development. You know, that it's about really a sort of construction of the self and then a presentation of the self to others that is still, you know, grounded in this kind of like capitalist context of like, what does it mean to be a person? Like, what does it mean to have a self?
100%.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, and it cannot be in any other way with the state of the left right now, because we have no way of tapping into the material interests of the working class or of any kinds of people. We do not have that kind of organic organizations which can meet people's needs. So all we can do is pander to people's identities. That's our only option right now.
When we say that, like, the left is thoroughly just infused with liberalism, we don't just mean that like they care too much about whether or not the fucking Avengers has representation of people of color and whatnot. Even our orientation to our anti-liberal ideologies is one that is viewed through the lens of liberalism. I mean, our self-branding, like I brand myself online as MLM. I've even got the little fucking, I've got the t-shirt to prove it. I've got the, like, the, my Twitter bio has got like a picture of, you know, some Cultural Revolution art in the background. That's, this is all branding. It's online branding. And a lot of people's, the only way people actually express these, fine distinctions and, internecine, Marxist minutia, is as like an identity that they take on for themselves. And it, for the most part, it's a very shallow understanding of what it even means.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and that's also true of class. Even the way we talk about class is, you know, it's this individuated self-conception. It's an identity marker, right? It's liberalism's version of what it means to be working class as like a cultural category. Mm. And if you watch Tucker Carlson do a rant about it, you know, it gets like, it sounds kind of like what we're talking about, but it's also altogether different, you know,
like way more racist.
Well, for example, but there, I mean, there's more to it too. It's like, there's this idea that's, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to make this a whole thing, right? But like, when you hear these sort of debates about the ID Paul left versus the normie socialism, in both cases, you're just talking about various ways in which people feel comfortable as individuals about how they relate to the world rather than what is in the interest of the class. Like on both types of left, it's all just talking about individual conceptions of the self.
Yes. And since it is only about conceptions of the self, distinctions become even more, aggravated and more important to the construction of the self, since there are no material basis for the identity. All that we can do is play with these symbols and draw sharper and sharper distinctions into more obscure groups. And that's not only with the left. I see the same thing within the Catholic Church, within all of our churches, where believers are no longer embedded in the sacraments, in the organizations of the church, and therefore we have seen the rise of the trad cats or the rad cats and so on, because the institutions and the material, the reality of the church and of the left has become unimportant in our daily lives. All that we have instead are these symbols and these distinctions that becomes a sort of cultural capital.
To me, this is the level of the critique that we have to be operating on. Because I think this is one of the things that I'm really glad we're talking about this. And that's why I was excited about this section, because it feels like we're getting down to this like deep, like the material context, or at least McHare-Hare is pointing towards a material context, which gives rise to this particular, you know, pattern of identity formation. So for me, it's like, if we're going to talk about being fucking radical and revolutionary, it's like, let's talk about how the self is constructed and what's the material basis for that. And why does it lead to certain ways to think about the self that are, you know, permeating across all different sorts of political positions?
Yeah.
So are we just aesthetically doomer communists? And that's why we have this, you know, this critique. Are we just like, is this just a branding exercise for us?
I mean, it could be. It could become that.
Why not both?
Easily.
Yeah, exactly. Why not both? I think the response would necessarily to that would necessarily have to be that maybe we are just another instantiation of the moment we live in. A Marxist or really a Hegelian account of history sees every moment and every path forward into the future arises out of contradictions that exist in what precedes it. So, like, you know, yeah, maybe we are just doomer communists, and we are just another identity and self-constructed self that we're criticizing here. But maybe this thing has produced a productive criticism of the very thing that we are.
I just want to say, I think we're making history, but not in the conditions of our own choosing, but dialectically it creates limitations and possibilities.
Interesting formulation, Adam. I wonder where you
that is. That is mine. It is totally mine. I just trademarked it. I branded it.
And also, like, the fact that there does exist a multiplicity of identity formation in the given system doesn't exclude the fact that one of these instantiations, in this case, Doomer Communism, is the concrete universality of the system. We are right.
There's always that.
Maybe just we're near time on this, so maybe just to close this, I can just talk or point to McCare Harris, the way he ties it together, this section together. He talks about how the creative revolution, which was the he calls the cybernetic counterculture, was not so much co-opted so as much as it was recognized fraternally by the culture and technological vanguard of corporate capitalism. So it embodied a corporate assimilation of romanticism, which he sees as a foreclosure on Bohemia, a copyright infringement on the sacramental imagination. He uses such beautiful language to describe this stuff that I can't help but just directly quote him.
Yeah, his writing
whenever he does this stuff.
So I have a question I want to put to you all about recuperation for the last part of this chapter. Whenever we talk about recuperation, I think I could see two different ways to think through it. One would be a sort of like a co-optation of certain trends or like counter, like, you know, anti-capitalist or like countercultural sorts of approaches. I could also see a different way to think about recuperation as kind of what McCare Harris is saying. It's almost like it's seen as this kind of place of generating new ideas and like new ways to, you know, sort of find places to develop profit or something. So it's not so much like a co-optation per se, but it's more of like a recognition of the necessity to inject like novelty back into the system. And I see those as kind of being two different things, if that makes sense. So I was curious how y'all think about it, since recuperation is kind of y'all's bag. I mean, being anti-recuperation, I should say.
Yeah.
Love to recuperate.
Recuperation's awesome. I mean, I think we've talked about this before as a sort of like, tell me if this is a faithful retreading of what you just said, but about the difference between it being like a function of an unconscious function of the system versus like a deliberate strategy.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, right on.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
I would say yes. I mean, it's kind of like a, you know, we often do this, right? We talk about like the capitalists want you divided. And so we talk about like racism as a tool of keeping workers divided. But anthropomorphizing the great other is an easier way, is a way of sort of like psychologically dealing with what it is, right? What it is to us, and making it simpler, even simplifying it and overly simplifying it. Of course, there isn't like a boardroom of capitalists that are like, oh shit, they're getting together, juice up the racism. However, there are capitalists that, or agents of capital that do deliberately employ, or deploy, you know, divide and conquer tactics in particular workplaces. And that does aggregate to an unconscious functioning of the system. I would say so too is the case for what we call recuperation, that there is the need to inject constant dynamism. And, you know, especially in the age of, the sort of more, you know, in the age of the focus group and advertisement, there is a more deliberate like seeking out of like what the kids are into. So I think that it's both, and I think it's hard to decide, it's hard to determine where one begins and the other ends. I would say that recuperation is the unconscious functioning of the system, and it has conscious agents within it, but it's not like the plan in some sort of bureaucratic sense of like the 5-year plan that's been agreed upon by the Politburo of capitalism. Does that make sense?
Just look at the two-pronged assault from corporate capitalism and the government of the United States in response to the George Floyd uprisings and the total recuperation of Black Lives Matter. I'd say that's a perfect illustration of what you just said.
I just want to say that I think that you're all completely right, but also that this externality of recuperation has become the driving force of at least our current instantiation of capitalism, that without recuperation, the system would stall. The system needs these kinds of subversion to keep going. And here, I think Judith Butler has a point that if you want to challenge a system, over-identify with it, do not subvert it. If you over-identify with the system, you show its own perversity. If you try to subvert it, then you will only give it this kind of ventiles to relieve the pressure and give rise to more new markets, as in the case of Black Lives Matters.
Phenomenal. Wow, that's great. So let's see. The next chapter is McCarrier titles it "The New Testament of Capitalism: The Resurgence of Evangelical Entrenchment and the Theology of Neoliberalism." And this is the section that I had been like seeing the stirrings of and the seeds of, and had been like, you know, picking at my brain all along throughout the entire rest of this book, was seeing the appearance into the world fully birthed as its present form is, of how the American evangelical Puritan Protestant section of society got entangled, entwined with, you know, market fundamentalism and neoliberalism, as it is now called. This is where he talks about, American Protestantism becoming a right-wing ideology, and Ayn Rand's, rehabilitation of the entrepreneur.
I mean, fuck. It's like the worst people of our... I can't say the worst people of that century. Produced a lot of really bad people.
Yeah, there were the Nazis.
That's right. There were such and things as Swiss commandants. Yeah.
And also Kissinger.
Yeah.
David Harvey writes, Neoliberalism has been both a utopian project to realize a theoretical design for the reorganization of international capitalism and a political project to reestablish the conditions for capital accumulation and to restore the power of economic elites. So how's that for setting the tone?
There you go. What do we think about that? Is that a convincing case? I think so. That neoliberalism, the neoliberalism is like a conscious political project.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I do really appreciate. I'm just going to mention, I appreciate that McCarrier talks about Philip Murawski, whose book, "The Road to Mount Pelerin," the book of essays about the history and development of neoliberalism and the early sort of ideological development as a conscious project, and the sort of divisions around, you know, the Chicago School, but also the Ordo Liberals in Germany. Phenomenal work. Also, his book on cybernetics and just like science and capitalist development, those things are must reads to me. So just to
plug those a little absolutely bit. They are so good. But they should also be complemented with The Masters of the Universe, which is a more popular written book about Mount Pelerin. And because of the fact that books do justice to the divisions within the neoliberal camps to a larger extent. For example, McCarrier does not point out the fact that a lot of, for example, Hayek went down the same road as many of the critics of capitalism when he pointed out that capitalism is detrimental to the social order and cannot stand on its own legs. There need to be a social shit to keep social relationships together, and the states have to stand for that. And much like the arts and craft movement, Hayek's supplement to capitalism was high culture or artisanship, and that had to exist outside the realm of capitalist competition. And I think it's interesting that the more intelligent neoliberals pointed out the fact that capitalism needs something external to itself, and that thing external to itself has to be aesthetic.
I don't know what I think about that.
I think in a way this is a consequence of the placing at the center of the capitalist system of the like entrepreneurial self, like the hyper atomized individual, right? Like, which is fundamentally going to be, you know, contra some sort of larger communal, like social sense of self, right? So I do think there is something to be said here about the necessity of seeing the implications of the kind of individualism that has to be placed at the heart of the system, creating your contradiction, and this being sort of, yeah, like a check on the destructive potential of that to the system itself.
And that was something even the more intelligent neoliberals realized, such as Hayek, which basically was the only one who was intellectually honest of them.
To follow a trajectory in the text here, he begins the discussion. I think he frames the chapter in terms of its neoliberal trajectory, but he goes back and I think he identifies its roots here in the victory of neoliberalism in the United States as stemming in part from the endurance of Protestant evangelical enchantment. Now he notes that the South in the U.S. was an enormous beneficiary of New Deal programs, but the evangelical religious culture fueled a dogged suspicion of activist government, part of a selective aversion to large-scale institutions that reflected the populist legacy. Southern evangelicals affirmed what Darren Dochuk has dubbed a, quote, plain folks, end quote, ideology, which this is the really interesting bit that he threads through the chapter, he says that this plain folks ideology is a modern evolutionary descendant of Herrenfolk democracy. White supremacy, patriarchal dominance, small government, antipathy toward cultural and economic elites, and the Protestant work ethic. They conflated the doctrines of Jefferson and Jesus and longed for the restoration of the middling splendors of the Protestant producers' republic.
I mean, yeah, they certainly do.
Yeah. That's like my ultimate dystopia, though, right there, is the Protestant producers' republic. It's like, if I have to imagine hell, that's what it is to me. That's where I go when I die, if I'm bad, is the Protestant producers' republic.
Yeah.
That's where I live.
The
also.
South in the United States, yeah.
Not just the South.
Right. The that's what we, you know, in our earliest episodes, we called the... To the extent that there was an American fascist palingenesis, it's actually, its ethos isn't exactly fascistic, right? But it is that. It is this thing here. It's the producers, the small proprietors republic, where every man is a property owner and controls it like a feudal lord almost. Yeah. Controls it like a fiefdom. Yeah. The bigger question, I think, is, how? How does that reemerge in such a significant way as to like become again the ruling ideology, and why the South, you know, in this particular period in time?
Probably because it's underdeveloped, and Walter Benjamin was right that behind every fascistic undertaking and cultural milieu is a failed communist revolution.
Right, because it does dovetail with the failure to enact the CIO's Operation Dixie plan of, like, you know, finishing the union drive and breaking the back of Jim Crow at the workplace, you know, as being like the principal sort of post-war goal of American labor.
Like, yes, also like, the long-term legacy of the failure of the redistributive project of the Reconstruction.
Yeah, and right. It's a series of failed grand social experiments that do stem exactly, like you said, from underdevelopment.
And it's not that hard to see a historical counterfactual scenario where the communists succeeded in forming a kind of post-colonial independent struggle in the South as a colonized people against the industrial powers of the North. I mean, it's not that far stretched to see that happen.
Yeah, I think that that's a really sharp insight, Mir, that you made of.
And that was just me who came up with that on on the go. I never heard it anywhere before.
Yeah.
So, question for y'all: what is the failed communist revolution behind the rise of the neo-fascist Donald Trump?
I don't think Trump's don't answer actually
that.
A fascist.
Don't that was the correct answer. Thank you.
Yep, there you go.
Shut the fuck up, Lib. That's my answer to that.
But, well, I was gonna draw out the point that McCarrahare makes, that after World War II, Southern workers and farmers rapidly shed their antagonism to corporate capital and embrace a newfangled version of the old evangelical gospel of wealth, and found themselves, millions of white evangelicals migrated from the South to the West, and in particularly in Southern California, where federal military spending was bankrolling the erection of a corporate fantasia, aerospace, electronics, and information firms, alongside services, entertainment, and recreation. So he's pointing out that the evangelicals denouncing you know, the New Deal's pagan statism, were actually being underwritten by the federal government. And he also notes, something that I found really interesting about the, in the mid 70s, the evangelicals becoming the amen chorus of the corporate enchantment. This arises out of a right wing lay intelligentsia funding a cultural apparatus of colleges, universities, seminaries, parachurch organizations, and publishing firms, flush with money from Howard J. Pugh of Sun Oil and other Protestant business leaders, who very consciously undertook the project of funding and constructing social institutions, promulgating what we now see today as the religious right in the United States.
It's a deliberate construction of a sort of like fifth column counterculture within the U.S., a very deliberate project and incredibly successful too.
Yeah. I mean, it basically, it goes from strength to strength all the way up to now. Well, that's, yeah, I guess that's not true. I guess there's a backlash.
But it doesn't seem to be relinquishing any its grip at all.
Oh, I meant like there's a backlash in the long 60s, and then it reasserts itself on a higher order in a stronger way, because it's not defeated. The backlash today is fucking pathetic compared to the last one.
Right. I know. I was just thinking about like the end of neoliberalism, the end of history kind of, you know, optimistic attitude that's sort of around the Jacobin milieu right now.
Yeah. It's
neoliberalism is over.
Somewhat overstated.
Somewhat.
I'm sure they just won't comment on it. We'll just write articles about other obscure leftist topics whenever they're in complete ideological structure collapses, as it usually does.
Yeah. Oh.
But one thing that should be emphasized is the fact that this is a trajectory which has basically doomed the evangelical milieu in the U.S., which has cannibalized itself, and especially since the election of Donald Trump, they have exorcised themselves and have shrunk beyond recognition, and has basically lost their religious roots and only become a political project. So like, this is a strategy which is not in the long term tenable, like not even in a 10-year cycle, because that conservative Christianity has exorcised the Protestant milieu it came out of.
Well, but it'll do a good enough job at maintaining capitalism, and then the B team will come back, and it will be,
yes,
it'll be woke and progressive and liberal, and then that will run out of steam, and then the A team will come back. And
absolutely, but like, it's almost as if the Protestant churches cannot serve Mammon and God at the same time without extinguishing themselves.
They're gonna try. What else do we think about this section?
I was going to let the sort of anything else on that subject sort of play out. And then the other half of this chapter is where he addresses the neoliberalism proper in sort of Randianism, where he says that the Herrenfolk enchantment was rejected by another more acerbic and bellicose wing of the Cold War right. Business people, economists, political philosophers, journalists, and other writers who were the direct progenitors of, quote, neoliberalism, end quote. So corporate executives bankrolled a labyrinth of institutes, foundations, and periodicals. Economists extended the moral purview of neoclassical economics. Philosophers turned the market from a site of commerce and production into a fundamental ontological reality. Journalists and novelists spread the nascent evangel of laissez-faire to millions of middle-class readers. Where he starts talking about the Chicago School of Neoclassical Economics and Ayn Rand and other such figures. An interesting point that he makes is that even and perhaps especially where neoliberalism was purportedly secular or disenchanted, it served to divinize market forces and exalt the entrepreneurial self, affirming the most complete apotheosis of pecuniary metaphysics in the history of capitalism. And then I suppose just to tie those two sections together, maybe to prompt discussion of this. At the same time, if evangelicals called on the Christian God to sustain the ontological legitimacy of capitalism, American neoliberals represented an elusive repudiation of the Jeremiad. I don't know how to say that out loud. Neoliberals represented an elusive repudiation of the Jeremiad tradition. Neoliberals realized that a beloved community could not be built on capitalist property, but rather than reject the property relations, they renounced and maligned the hope of community. Even when they invoked tradition and religion, neoliberals echoed the roseate transcendentalism of money portended by Emerson. In the neoliberal theology of the market, the world is a business. Money is the measure of all things. Mercenary professionalism or technical talent is the existential equivalent of sanctity. And the successful entrepreneur is the autocratic icon of morality and beatitude.
There's no such thing as society.
That's right. There are no grand narratives, and there's no such thing as society. There are no classes. There are just people.
Yeah, you individuals know? And the way that they act.
To Margaret Thatcher, it's explicitly said, there is no such thing as society. There are individuals and there are families, which I think is the most interesting thing. Bit of that quote from her is the "and there are families," because the second you leave "there are only individuals," she's immediately moving over "there are families." Okay, there are families now. Why are families units and not any other grouping of people?
Well, social reproduction has to continue somehow.
Yeah. Just imagine telling conservative British people there's no such thing as families.
Right. But it is great because it immediately points to like the family as a unit, as a collective identity, which is a greater than the sum of its individual parts, something greater than oneself that one contributes to and derives meaning from as the seed of collectivism all over again, because the family is the seed of society all over again. And so, in a way, Miss Thatcher, by your logic,
are you about to, well, actually, Margaret Thatcher?
Well, actually.
You're going to mansplain this powerful woman?
Yes. Listen, You only have to be you have to be successful every time. We only have to be successful once.
Yeah. Word.
Such an inspirational quote.
Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. No, I really like this exegesis. Is I using that word right?
Exegesis, yeah.
Yeah.
Of the whole essence of neoliberalism as being like the recognition of the impossibility of the beloved community on the basis of market society. And so then thus the rejection of the beloved community in favor of market society and the wholesale reordering of the superstructure and all of its attendant sort of ideological outgrowths and social consequences around the, you know, well, sure, we can't make life decent and holy, but we can maintain the market. And it is just like, it has to present itself as anti-ideological the way that it does, right? Because if it doesn't, then the only thing left is to recognize its viciously, sociopathic approach to the world. Nobody wants to be very few people, like Murray Rothbard maybe, but very few normal humans want to be the standard bearers of an explicitly anti-person ideology until you get to the 4chan era anyways.
Well, I also think that if we're talking about neoliberalism, and since we already mentioned Philip Murawski, it's very important to focus on the fact that neoliberalism is an epistemological project through and through, where the only knowledge of society and social relationship we can get is through market transaction as an aggregate of other social relationships. So the only knowledge we can get out of the divine, of art, of other more profound encounters is always mediated through monetary transactions within the neoliberal framework.
This is a good point to come back to who McCarahare calls the wisest mandarin of neoliberalism, Hayek, and this is on page 593. He says that Hayek turned laissez-faire from an economic principle into an ontology, identifying capitalist enterprise as an exemplary emanation of cosmic design. In this view, the humility enjoined by Hayek is the enabling virtue of capitalist markets, permitting the efflorescence of entrepreneurial ingenuity and the attainment of a quote-unquote spontaneous order without the arrogant and peremptory ministrations of government. It is impossible, Hayek wrote in 1973, to improve or correct this order by interfering in it by direct commands. Yet Hayek himself believed that both the spontaneous order of the market arose from human artifice and that this artifice must be concealed within a stupefying haze of metaphysical enchantment. Then talks about Hayek advocating what was called the double truth doctrine, similar to what Leo Strauss advocated, that there's like the truth for the elites, and then there's the truth for everyone else down below who are too dumb to understand what actually has to happen for society to function at all.
Oh, it's Maslin, right?
Heyo! Mic drop, like, so episode over.
So basically, instead of philosopher kings, we get economic professors. That sounds really bad.
Yeah. Well,
whoops.
But they are the philosopher kings. It's just that the true philosophy is merely management. It's business.
Sad reactions only.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't realize how long of an episode this is going to have to be.
Yeah, there's a lot here. When I was doing the notes for it, I was like, holy fuck, I have so much to do. Thankfully, here's the thing though. Thankfully, I think the next section we can just blow through. It's just liberals' response to you know, the rise of neoliberalism.
Hey, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Perhaps
greatest chapter summary of all time.
No, girls can be bosses.
So the next chapter is the statues of Daedalus, the postmodern, postmaterialism, and the failure of the liberal imagination. This is in this section. McCarahare discusses liberals' response, the classic sort of the liberals' of the New Deal era responding to the rise of neoliberalism. So he says that liberals could point to the success of the New Deal's mixed economy as evidence of the corporate commonwealth, as evidence that the corporate commonwealth could both forestall more radical measures at home and offer an example to post-colonial nations attracted to revolutionary socialism.
I mean,
liberals shared Nixon's premise that consumer abundance would diminish the appeal of communism. And this is, I think we might have even discussed this earlier, where appearance of home ownership across society was used explicitly to forestall the rise of communism. And Cold War liberalism was seen primarily as a sobering moment in American intellectual life, as ex-radicals recovered from their youthful intoxication with Marxism during the Depression. Faced with the horrors of Stalinism and the waning of popular front enthusiasm, former socialists and communists languished in what Daniel Bell called the exhaustion of utopia. Mm-hmm. Hence, so the story goes, the gray mood of liberals in the 1950s exemplified in the rhetorical ensemble of, quote, realism, maturity, responsibility, complexity, and irony, virtues that countered the utopian vices of doctrinaire zeal and indifference to limits.
You hear that, communists? Grow up, pull your pants up, get a real job.
And you heard it
Nancy
here
Pelosi.
First. Irony is counter revolutionary. Stuck with it.
Yeah, it really is.
But not meta irony.
The gray mood of liberals in the 1950s sounds like so fucking like utopian and imaginary compared to the black mood of liberals of the 2010s and 20s.
Oh yeah. You know what though, on the topic of irony, this last week I read a book about morale of soldiers in World War I and how irony is just a coping mechanism for severe trauma. So I mean like,
yeah.
It's a universal coping mechanism. They found it in instances in all over for all troops, dark humor, gallows humor, irony, extreme sarcasm. We can't really help it. It's just a human coping mechanism.
The greatest of all coping mechanisms.
Right. There's no other way to explain the like supreme dominance and prevalence of irony among our generation and the young guns coming up behind us. Extreme irony. We live in very traumatic times thanks to the gray mood of liberals.
This is why I say the YouTuber J-Reg will really save us all. He's my patron saint.
I don't know what you're saying, so I'm going to take it as disrespect.
You should take it as disrespect.
You're forgetting that Adam is not of our generation.
My generation and the young guns coming up behind us.
Jason, you and
Adam,
I are the same age. But I have the heart of a zoomer. I have the heart of a zoomer, though.
We actually are like the same age, exactly.
Yeah, we're 30. Yeah, we're both 36. Yeah.
Why am I thinking you're a fucking zoomer? I'm like barely older than you.
I know. It's just I have the heart of a zoomer. I'm not fucking joking. This is not irony. This is post-sincerity.
Yeah, Adam just doesn't perform millennial.
That's right. Yeah, I'm very, yeah, my performativity is definitely much more grounded in the Zoomer generation.
I mean, look, it's better than performing Gen X-isms as a millennial.
Oh, God. The worst generation of all time.
So,
no arguments here about that.
So Daniel Bell identified in 1960.
Hey, you're in charge, Kevin. You're supposed to keep us on track.
Thus, what Daniel Bell identified in 1960 as the end of ideology, code for the ebbing of Marxism, presupposed an interlocking set of revolutions of unprecedented magnitude. So this is the governing philosophy of the post-industrial avant-garde would emanate, liberal writers hoped, from the new post-war university. In the disciplinary protocols of the post-war university, liberal humanists pursued their clerical roles with a keen sense of cultural professionalism, a sense of moral and aesthetic expertise, much like that exhibited among scientists and technicians.
So can we just stop a moment and face the fact that the liberal utopia of this age was the reality of the managerial age, which has just passed?
Yeah.
Just wanted to throw this in here. It's just a bit of a historical anecdote I found interesting, that in the Port Huron statement from Tom Hayden, in the SDS, very, very important historical document of the New Left. I don't remember them being so pro-automation in that. So that was actually an interesting connection that, yeah, I wasn't aware of.
I actually don't remember that either.
Yeah, this is just really quick on 613. He says, in the Port Huron statement, a manifesto of the SDS, or Students for a Democratic Society, and a blueprint of civic paradise, Tom Hayden maintained that automation, now pursued within a system of selfish production motives and elitist control, nonetheless afforded the opportunity for men the world around to rise in dignity from their knees. Anyway, just a historical anecdote I found interesting.
I've gotten real sidetracked. I'm currently reading the Port Huron statement. We're very into nuclear energy too.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways, I'll put this aside.
If anybody's got any more discussion on that section, I think we can glide past it. If not, okay.
Management bad. I understand. That's it. Okay.
Yeah. So hence the sense of sacrilege felt by many liberal academics when confronted by opposition from radical students in the counterculture. And this is where McHare goes into the next chapter. To live instead of making history. Herbert Marcuse, Norman O. Brown, and the romantic eschatology of immanence. So he discusses the rise of the New Left as what he calls the utopian impulse having not completely atrophied. So the very notion that material scarcity had either had been or would soon be overcome was itself redolent of ancient eschatological presentiments of recovered Edens or heavenly cities. Realism, the New Left held, realism remained the Medusa's head raised to admonish all visionaries to stone.
Eschatology, that's the study of jazz, right?
I actually had to look it up. It's like the study. It is the theological study of death, the soul, and a couple of other like far ranging,
most
things.
Notably the study of the end of times.
Yeah, and the final judgment.
That's right, and the final judgment.
The secular eschaton of communism is the glorious and virtuous workers' world republic.
So in the face of the liberal Wiseman, utopia had its champions in C. Wright Mills, Norman O. Brown, and Herbert Marcuse, who dismissed liberal injunctions to realism and maturity as evidence of betrayal and resignation. Tutors of the American New Left, they called on radicals to challenge the canons of rationality that both liberals and conservatives took for granted. Utopians shared with liberals the premise of an impending end to material scarcity and the predatory ethos that it spawned. Pointed to the necessity of transcending capitalist social relations rather than saying that we should all just sit back and let abundance happen under the rubric of capitalist society. And I think this encapsulates it. With the student and countercultural movements undoubtedly in mind, he countered Marcuse by declaring, this is Brown, countered Marcuse by declaring that the next generation needs to be told that the real fight is not the political fight, but to put an end to politics. We must pass, Brown concluded, from politics to poetry.
Oh, that sounds nice.
Well, also right, foreshadows about his conclusions a little bit at the end of the book.
Talk about like a wolf in sheep's clothing. That's a guy who's on our side?
He's according to McHare, this is a foundational thinker.
Well, I think that
of the New Left.
Yeah, I mean, I think what McHare is doing in this chapter is trying to connect up Brown and Marcuse and even C. Wright Mills to the romantic anti-capitalist tradition, right? This is the thread that he's trying to draw. It's like, this is where you're going to find this trend in this era. So I'm going to read a quote real fast about Marcuse and One Dimensional Man before we move on, if that's cool. So this 626, he says, part of the left melancholia that pervaded One-Dimensional Man stemmed from Marcuse's identification with false needs and repressive desublimation. The cultural industries fostered spurious needs to ensure the steady accumulation of capital, while the liberalization of sexual mores distracted from psychic and political repression. This pessimism persisted even after One-Dimensional Man, while Marcuse was becoming an avuncular mentor and revolutionary consciousness to the New Left. He continued to believe that false needs had proliferated to the point that the most urgent revolutionary task was to, quote, transform the will itself so that people no longer want what they now want, unquote. Shackled to the system by invisible chains of fraudulent wants and counterfeit freedom, the inhabitants of capitalist societies required a revolutionary transformation of desire. So, I feel like this is exactly the tradition that McCarraher is trying to align himself with in this whole critique of this book as well. I mean, I think that that's, to me, where his politics really starts to come through and what his conclusion is going to be, is that it's about this revolutionizing of the nature of desire and the sort of infrastructure of the individual and the human being.
Yes, but he does not, and to foreshadow the critique, basically his recipe is that we should raise ourselves up by our bootstraps. Without any material foundation, just change our own desires, which has always been one of my critiques of Herbert Marcuse.
Yeah, I think you're right, and he pretty explicitly draws this connection in his opening of the final chapter before the epilogue. The final chapter is heaven, which exists and is everywhere around us. The sacramental vision of post-war utopians. And this is the section of that I identified at the outset as the other critics that he sort of lumps together as being rooted in a revival of the arts and crafts movement, that I think we can see that this is the school that he sees himself in. He very much so writes it in such a way that it appears that he's writing himself here. But he says, if Brown eschewed politics in favor of poetry, others saw no chasm or incommensurability between the two realms. These others, I think, would include himself.
Well, that's true, but this is a problem with McCarraher and the liberals, is that their vision is always political and not social or economical in its nature. They are trapped in this liberal alienation of these different spheres, where the foundational utopia is political and not social, and the delusion that we can change the political without first changing our social relationships.
You mean like changing the world without taking power?
Yep.
It's pretty sus in retrospect.
Big sus. Yep.
Turns out you can't do that.
Yeah, to put it in McCarraher's language, he says the aversion of radical students throughout the North Atlantic countries to both liberal democracy and really existing socialism convinced many observers that there is a sense in the air, especially among the young, not only that Marxism and liberalism have in good measure ceased to provide explanations of the world, but also that they have become part of what requires explanation. So in other words, liberalism and Marxism, from this point of view, are both things to be overcome. But this, McCarraher says, opens up a possibility for fresh and untested sources of revolutionary vision and vitality. Talks about the personalists.
I don't know about untested and fresh, but certainly other.
I'll agree with that part.
But like looking back to the personalist imagination, taking inspiration from the Catholic worker movement. Not that you shouldn't do these things, right? But it's just, again, it's like, I don't know if that qualifies as fresh and untested.
No, and especially not untested, like the Christian Democrats in Germany, they are personalists and they have been in power forever.
And they're somehow even worse than the Social Democrats in Germany.
Yeah, they are. How dare you respect the feminist champion of Angela Merkel?
Man, just Jesus. So there is something here that is like, right. In terms of things that need, that require explanation, right? There, it is actually the case that, like he says, that the Marxism, at least the dominant Marxism of the time, promised little more anyways than cosmetic change to the apparatus when it comes to, the experience of human beings. Let's say the spiritual life, right? The the question of the disalienation of labor and of humans from each other and nature, that like very clearly is like not resolved by the coming to power of communist parties and the reshaping of the productive regime in Eastern Europe and in Southeast Asia. Like, you know, looking at it at the time and like looking at the fact that there are like workers' revolts in East Germany and in Hungary and stuff, you see why there are people who are like, well, shit, okay, I guess Marxism hasn't really explained anything. It requires an explanation now too. Like, how do you account for the fact that there could be a workers' revolt against the workers' state? So I do think we have to have some sympathy or at least some understanding with the fact that this is the route that people like McHarrahare are taking. It's like, we do, I mean, that's kind of our whole ethic about surveying the wreckage of this whole last century, is that we haven't really, fixed anything.
Yes, and especially with like these ossified communist parties where these people grew up in, who were nightmarish, Stalinist, controlled, dysfunctional in every way. Like, if I were 10 years older than I am, I would probably have grown up in the communist part of Sweden. And I would also like, nah, Marxism, not a great thing.
Right. Although I am really fond of this. There's an old like Russian joke from the 90s that goes like, what has capitalism done for Russia in 8 years that socialism couldn't do in 80 years? Or maybe it's 7 years and 70 years, whatever it is, right? And then the answer is make socialism look really good.
He's rehashing the arts and crafts movement and saying it was good and we should do it again. Adam, were you going to say something about this section?
Yeah, actually, I think there is something I'm fairly critical of, and I think McHarrahare is a little too uncritical of, which is the shift towards quote-unquote Eastern religions of Buddhism Taoism and such as kind of, and people like Thomas Merton, Gary Snyder, Alan Watts, who, you know, I spent a lot of years studying and listening to a lot of them prior and reading their works prior to, you know, becoming a fucking rabid communist. And I still have a lot of admiration for them, but I think that McHarrahare is pointing to them as saying that they exemplify the shift towards some sort of resacralizing of the world or some sort of resistance to capitalism. But I think that we've talked about this a bit on our show. I think this is wholly uncritical of the way that those figures themselves were also adopted and playing into the sort of new managerial tactics of capitalism and the, you know, development of like mindfulness as this like corporate, you know, disciplinary technique par excellence. And I found it a little strange to like look at these figures in this way. And yeah, just be like fairly uncritical of how they were actually like not very critical of capitalism in many ways. And I think ended up just being, you know, quote unquote recuperated to enormous effect, which is, I think, one of the things we see right now as a primary like function of capitalist ideology to discipline ourselves in this Foucauldian way as workers to exploit ourselves even further, or how, you know, hedge fund managers will go to Vipassana retreats and meditate for 10 days so they can, you know, make better trades and not be, you know, psychologically devastated by, you know, making a bad bet on the market.
Well, right. Like we've, you know, there have been a couple of Mad Men references in this discussion today, and the ultimate one is the final scene of the show, right? The series conclusion. Yeah. It's like, I don't know if the writers of that show meant for that to be a damning indictment of the entire society that we live in, that these people and like, you know, the Don Draper types, but the real ones actually helped bequeath to us, right? Or about the intersection of an apolitical spiritualism,
I was going to say, I think they probably did.
Yeah. Cause if they didn't, they did a good job doing it on accident. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, that could open up a whole discussion about, you know, how effective it is to make a really good critique as a media product and what recuperation does to those things, right? But nevertheless, it serves as a good point of reference anyways.
Just think of all of the like multi-layered criticisms of American society that were made by the producer of the show in The Sopranos. I mean, so it wouldn't surprise me if he's like doing that again. Well, I mean, he is doing that again all throughout Mad Men, but if that was his message with that final scene.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And to reiterate Adam's critique of the way he uncritically pandered to Eastern spirituality and these figures, as Zizek pointed out, if Max Weber would write the capitalism and the Protestant worth that ethic today, he would probably write the new spirit of capitalism and the Buddhist work ethic.
Right. I mean, who are the major figures in the West of Eastern spiritualism? Not in the period that MacGyver is talking about, right? But like in this moment, like who do you associate with Buddhism? Especially if you're not familiar, it's like fucking Steve Jobs. Or like maybe Richard Gere at best, you know.
Steven Seagal.
Yeah.
Steven Seagal is the ultimate.
Right, exactly. Like these are the apostles of the New Age. And I think New Age is the right way to talk about it, because obviously Buddhism is not new, but the reconceptualization of a certain series of spiritual schools as means by which individuals can repair themselves and prepare themselves for further alienation so as to not challenge the things which cause the alienation, cause the psychological damage, but merely like it's like basically serves as like a nap in between shifts so that you can get back out there.
And
it's consciously so even. It's not even like an accident. They're just, you know, these are people who A, don't believe that you can change the world, but more importantly, B, hope that you don't try to.
Yes, because that whole theology has the mindset that the world cannot be changed. It is an eternal circle. So they have no conception of the fall from grace. Therefore, you can only have this kind of stoic techniques of making life more not as shitty to live in.
Right. I mean, and it is different than the dictum I've learned whatsoever my situation therewith to be content, right? It's different than Peter Paul in the fortress, you know, in the prison, singing praises of their savior, even though they're, you know, going to be tortured or whatever. Although the way that you learn that lesson, especially as a Protestant in the United States in this era, is precisely for the purpose of essentially making the same case, right? Because that's how thoroughly, you know, mammonized a religion, whether it's Christianity or it's, you know, whatever you imagine, you know, people in an Asian country that you don't know anything else about might believe. It's all bad.
This is where I become very torn on MacGyver, because as someone who has studied and practiced, you know, Buddhism in certain respects, and then, you know, aspects of the yoga traditions and studying Hindu philosophy, I mean, I think that it's important to recognize, like, there is something there, right? But the way that it gets contextualized and utilized within these sort of regimes of capitalist management and what it does to it and the complete leveling down of whatever it has to say that could be utilized in a very critical way against it, I think is, like, it's egregious to me that, again, that isn't talked about, like, the way that it could be utilized or it has been utilized, I think, in MacGyver's section. I mean, this is something that jumped out at me. It's on page 649. He's talking about Gary Snyder, who was, again, really foundational member of the Beats. He was a poet, very, like, sort of like an early figure and, like, very focused on ecology and, like, nature and such. But he says, looking to Dharma revolutionaries practicing the joyous and voluntary poverty of Buddhism, Snyder advocated a Buddhist anarchism, or true communionism, a mystico-anarchist version of the old, less free, international, classless world. The movement that Snyder envisioned combined the Wobblies and the Bodhisattva. This is Snyder, building a new world in the shell of the old, required learning the way of the Buddha, fusing the simplicity of the Eightfold Path with the solidarity of one big union. I just found that to be
a new wine in old skins. You cannot
there you go
find yeah, old skins.
nicely done there, Mir. You know what's funny is until I actually read that word, I always thought the word was bodhisattva.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fucking stoner.
Yeah, bro.
I knew that one.
Just blaze it. All right, so I have a question for y'all. This is why I'm of two minds. for a group of folks who, at least maybe most of us on the call, I don't know about you, Mir, maybe you do, but as people who, you know, very much are proselytizing about dialectical pessimism, revolutionary pessimism, I mean, I think I am very, very sympathetic to, you know, building a new world in the shell of the old. I think that is an aspect or an implication of that sort of position. So I'm very sympathetic to that. But then I'm also just ruthlessly critical of the way that, again, like he's kind of talking about or not talking about the way that, you know, this sort of looking to the East, quote unquote, from the West as a way to do this, again, was just also just effectively and fairly smoothly incorporated back into capitalism itself. So I don't really know what I make of this, honestly, at this point, to be like, well, in agreement, but I mean, also very critical.
Yeah, but basically it's some kind of Orientalism, and also if we're talking with psychoanalytic terms, it is the other supposed to know. Like, the great revolutions are always happening in China, and if we pick traditions from other places, we don't have to confront and exercise our own demons and salvage something workable from the ruins of our own society, because we cannot build something new within a shell that is breaking. We have to salvage some things from the ruins, not try to make this shell whole.
So basically, third worldism is cultural appropriation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Well, you know what else? I don't really like Daft Punk, and I don't care who knows it.
That is not being cut out of the episode.
I don't either.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a thing because they broke up and everyone's like, oh, Daft Punk. And I was like, I don't think I know what that band sounds like. So I went and checked them out. I was like, oh, right. No, I don't care for this at all.
Hey, at least we can all agree that vaccinations are a scam to put a microchip in us, right?
Oh, of course, of course.
Yeah, but of course I do want to put microchips in everybody because I am in the Illuminati.
I am I'm, but personally, I just like scams. So,
yeah, so it's something as long as the lizard overlords are happy, I am willing to comply.
Yeah. I'm sort of something of a scam aficionado, scam artiste, if you will.
There we go.
All right, folks, the epilogue.
Let's auger this motherfucker in.
The visionary commonwealth never came to pass. The business civilization did, with a vengeance. The American century morphed into the neoliberal market everlasting. Unfettered free trade and globalization epitomized by the formation of the WTO in 95, the privatization of public services and their lucrative relegation to the caprice of the marketplace, the reinvention of government agencies along the lines of corporate bureaucracies, and the maniacal deregulation of finance and industry under the rubric of modernization, liberating corporations from stifling restrictions on their freedom to invest, pollute, and exploit.
Fleet Ayn Rand is happy.
I'll praise her name.
Fuck that. Not even as a joke.
Ooh, I pushed irony too far for Chris.
Yep. I keep seeing this Sartre quote floating around that says the only thing the Bolsheviks ever did wrong was give Ayn Rand a free education. I don't know if it's true, but I want it to be true. And even if it's not, it's true.
Whether or not it's factual is incidental to whether or not it's true.
Yeah, there we go.
So I'd like to read McCarraher's, what I feel like is probably the best statement of his, I don't know, political conclusion or what he's advocating at the end of this.
Yeah.
So it's on 674. He says, our best hope for an imaginative and political antithesis to capitalist enchantment resides in the lineage of romantic sacramental radicalism. It understands calamity and justice and degradation as predicaments of human divinity, hardships that can reveal our suppressed or perverted but nonetheless godlike nature. It views the material universe as a cosmic theater of divine vitality charged with the grandeur of God. The capacity to apprehend paradise had several names, imagination, wonder, passionate vision, sacramental consciousness, but it has always been a way of seeing, a perception of some truth and goodness and beauty intrinsic to the material world, a view that embraces without nullifying the knowledge attainable through the sciences. So I guess it's a way of seeing the world that he's advocating at the end, right? This sort of seeing the universe that we're a part of, the materialist world that we're a part of at, in this particular way.
Yeah, it's, what do I want to say about that?
It's too idealistic.
Yes, and it's also an aesthetification of politics.
Yeah.
And of religion.
But I understand the impulse that he has to say this. And I think that communists, Marxists, can learn a lot from this way of thinking. But like I said, it's just like, yeah, like you said, it was an aestheticization of politics and incredibly idealistic.
That being, yeah, I mean, but it is important, right? Like we have had some discussions about the need for a kind of a virtue ethics, which is something we have to construct rather than hope it arises out of new conditions in the class struggle. There's got to be some recognition of the role of the subjective factor in defining terms, right? In defining in foisting a worldview. And I mean, I think yes, I agree with you that there's something to appreciate in here. In trying to give people an alternative way to view the world that they consciously maybe already have a distaste for, but don't really know what to do about it. It is a matter of like providing an explanation. But it does fall short. It's lacking because it is pure idealism.
Yes, and it also focuses on the middle stratas of society, of the petite bourgeoisie, of the middle classes, who are middle or highbrow in their cultural consumption. If we juxtapose McCarraher to, say, Walter Benjamin, who was much more focused on the rubble and the popular culture, who was available to the proletariat, and which also was the culture of the early Christians, the popular culture, which is something that is quite foreign to this aesthetification of politics, which McCarraher is driving through.
Yeah. I mean, I think a couple of things that we could just take from the welcoming the demise of empire as a, yeah, something to deliberately celebrate it.
Who else are gonna bomb my relatives in the Middle East if you guys don't do it?
Well, so we'll arm your relatives' neighbors so they can bomb each other. We'll outsource it all.
That's the liberal version of peace, by the way.
Yeah. Well, it once was. Now it's just straight up, let's, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. That was like the Bill Clinton and the version of peace.
But also like this, you know, it should be no surprise that I think that, you know, consciously adopting the mantle of the romantic left is something that we ought to do to help awaken people from the spell of the American dream. But that's where it gets a little tricky because it does dangerously skirt the edges of the wake up sheeple faux populism the kind of elitist anti-populism that exists on, you know, in some sort of sections of the left. Ultimately, really, all of this comes back to like, what are the material roots, the tangible roots to the battles of the class? And how can we then inject these sentiments, right? This worldview, this experimental attitude, into those things, and yeah, that's what he doesn't have. It is like you said, a pure aestheticization of politics.
Yes, and it's also an aesthetification of the middle classes. Like, yeah. I don't see, because we have to, as communists, we have to find ways to create mythologies, romantic mythologies through the popular culture that people are engaging with. Even though I love reading Proust and high culture, most people won't do that. We have to engage with the popular mythologies that are part of the daily realities of people.
So what would you all describe those as? right now?
That's an important question. What are the popular mythologies right now?
Disney,
Marvel.
Yeah, I was going to say superhero movies.
Yeah.
Well, no, but like broadening those things out to
Minions, like, memes.
Yeah, sure. Abstract those things to the level of like what they speak to rather than the form, right? What's the content of those things?
Well, that there's still justice to be had, and that ultimately the American project is one of fairness, inequality, and justice. That's one.
Yeah, that's the popular mythology that we talk about a lot. The sort of the tinkering with the machine that is a fundamentally designed well, had decent engineers that put it together, but its proper functioning depends on who the operator is at a given moment. That is an extremely popular myth. And you can see how popular it is by looking at how, you know, like we said earlier in this discussion, that kids in cages got repackaged as a migrant overflow facilities overnight, right? Because the only thing that changed in that machinery was who had their hands on the lever.
And how?
But how do you engage with this popular mythology? That's the question.
Well, my question is, I mean, is something that McCareher does offer, though, a way to try to construct, like, dare I say, a counter mythology? I mean, is that also something that is fundamentally flawed in its sort of aestheticization of politics, the way that we're talking about?
I would say if it is a counter-mythology of the elites, which I would say that McCareher is striving towards, I would say yes. It doesn't have to be. Like, I share the same cultural habitats as McCareher, but if I were to speak in that language to my colleagues or so forth, when I try to unionize people, they would look at me as a total freak. Then I have to bring up examples from, I don't know, Black Panther or Captain America or X-Men.
I gotta say, at this particular moment, I am resolute in my refusal to accept that's how we have to do it.
No, we don't have to do it that way, but we have to find a way out of that binary.
Yes. Okay, right. I agree. Yeah.
And I think McCareher, by only focusing on a specific cultural habitat, he makes it impossible to create something else.
We don't have an answer for your question, Adam.
No. No, and I only came to think of this as I was speaking, so this is not a fully formed thought.
I don't know if I have an answer either. I mean, I do think, if we're talking about, you know, the sort of common or like popular mythology, I mean, I think about, you know, not only like my colleagues, but the people I work with who, at least in the U.S. and in Texas and in my particular city, are the most marginalized and oppressed people, you know, in the city. And I think about, like, what, whenever I talk with them about things, you know, doing therapy work and counseling and such, right? I mean, you're talking about the most fundamental personal structures of belief and making sense of the world a lot of the time. And I do think there are moments where I'm like surprised to hear how much like my thinking as like, you know, a dialectical pessimist or whatever the hell, like does seem to resonate like very strongly. Or like in a lot of ways, like they're more radical than I am sometimes. And so to me, it's a very complicated thing I'm thinking through of like, yeah, like I do see the necessity of what McCareher is doing. I think of it as like a, I don't know. I mean, I do think it's ideal, like it's pure idealism, but part of me is like, but idealism in itself is like a materialist thing as well. And I think about it as like a necessary but not sufficient condition. That's like what frustrates me about it, is I see like the necessity of having a way to see the world this way, that to me is a profoundly like religious way to see the universe. And that's what I really love about it. Also granting like what you're saying too, Mir, but I do think that McCareher has like a definite class position and travels in certain circles. And I think it isn't, to me, like it speaks to why he wrote the book the way that he did. I just think that that's a pretty clear class implication of like how he's writing. And yet I'm also like, I still see a really necessary approach to like incorporating this sort of like, yes, like seeing the world as like, oh, what does he say? I just like quoted it a second ago. But yeah, calamity and justice and degradation as predicaments of human divinity. Like, I'm very strongly in support of that. And just trying to make sense of, you know, like for me, whenever I think about like what are counter mythologies, it's almost like it's sort of like recuperating back the cultural myths of capitalism, like, and subverting them and making them perverse in a new way. Like, that's, I think, for me, what I've leaned towards is seeing like these things as the storehouse of like an almost infinite ability to reconstruct myths and narratives for revolutionary potential. But we have to like shift our orientation towards it in a different way. Which, well, I think is a right, profoundly psychoanalytic way to think about it too.
Right. Well, it makes me think about
it's necessary but not sufficient. I mean, I completely agree. It's necessary but not sufficient.
Yeah. That was kind of my final takeaway from it. But Jason, what were you gonna say?
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, maybe we're thinking about popular mythologies in too narrow a way, right? Like, what's another popular mythology that might not appear to us as that at first glance is the idea that we're living through the goddamned end of the world. Right? Like, and it's a thing that everyone has embraced.
Hell yeah.
And sort of accepted, and it's part of how they talk about everything, but with resignation, right? And so our entire foundational premise here is that a better end of the world is possible, right? So you want to engage with a popular mythology that has some sort of, you know, rousing effect. It's not, oh, the tinkering with the machine, but in a good way, which is the way that the average, the revival of American socialism. And I think in a lot of ways, if you look at the sort of broad left regroupment parties of Europe over the last 20 years have been similar, right? That's the way you engage with that mythology. The way that we're trying to engage with the popular mythology is by saying, like, yes, they're driving it into the ground. They're creating chaos. They can't manage the society. Their system is horrendous, and we're not trying to save it. We actually think that we're gonna strap ourselves to this thing and ride it into the ground with them, and we're going to defeat them in the process, or we're going to try and construct a new world on the ruins of that, you know, of that catastrophe, because the catastrophe is unavoidable. The only question is, what do we do afterward? And that seems to me like a much more creative and nimble way of thinking than adopting the alternative mythology, which is that we can somehow right the course and save the system and then use the system to undermine itself.
The battle is what parts of the ruins we will save after the collapse.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
This is McCara here on 678. A realized eschatology, if you will. The future in the present tense, living the new world and the wreckage of the old. So are we more in agreement with McCara here than it initially appears? I mean, I like the idea of a realized eschatology. I just think that's fucking heavy metal.
I mean, I said something similar earlier.
Yeah.
That's also a line from Solidarity Forever. So it is really very much baked into our history, right? We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, right? Mm. Not by ascending to the top of the staircase and then erecting, constructing another floor, right? From the ashes of the old, right? The passion of destruction is a creative joy. That's gotta be the way that we think of these things.
Yes, but also it's imperative to begin to live. We cannot start to live because then we fall into weird anarchist cults. Like,
well, we don't want that.
That's bad. We don't want that.
I'm against that.
And it is a very thin line. And McCarraher, like, we have to begin to live. Yeah, but he emphasizes the living, while I would emphasize the beginning. Because you cannot put, to sound like a broken record, you cannot put new wine in old wine sacks. We have to start preparing the ground for a new way of living. We cannot find that new way of life until the collapse has happened, but we can lay the foundations for another kind of life.
Yep. Manure of history.
That is a manure
of history.
Yeah. Right. That is part of the dialectical in dialectical pessimism, right?
Can McCarraher imagine that kind of dialectics?
I wouldn't put it on him to do so. I think he could write a book though. We all have a role to play. So, like, Adam, you said, do we agree with McCarahan more than we originally thought? It's like on maybe the most important thing. Yes, I think so.
Thank you.